Okay, Eurofolk Radio is up. And let's start Talk Shoe. Here we go.
Talk Shoe. Recorded live.
All right, ladies and gentlemen. Pastor Eli James here, and this is Yahweh's Covenant People. And last week I began a series on the migrations of Caucasian Israel. And I'm going to continue this because I've been very gratified to find on the internet more and more websites, videos, audios about Israel's migrations. And it's not just identity people or well-known identity people, it's other people coming around and saying the same thing. So it's really good stuff. It's really good stuff. And I'm going to start here. Let me give you the website here. This is actually a website devoted to the works. It claims to be the complete works of Bertrand Comparé. So I'm going to post this in the chat room here. And so you can follow along. That's what I'm going to be reading from. It's actually starts on page 81. And the pages themselves are not numbered, but on the sidebar, there's like a little, I don't know what you'd call it. It's a little square that you can slide up and down, the little slide, and that has numbers next to it. You get down to page 81, that's Historic Proof of Israel's Migrations by Bertrand Comparé. However, even before I do that, I found this really great video of, let's see, what happened to it? not Bertrand Comparé, Sheldon Emery. It was Sheldon Emery. Let me go back one. I think here it is. Yeah, okay, this is an interview between Sheldon Emery and E. Raymond Capt. And so I'm going to start the show off by playing this. This is called The Migrations of the Lost Tribes of Israel, Saxons, Scythians, etc. And I will play this and make a few comments as it goes along. So here we go. And while this is playing, I'll get the URL and post this also in the chat room.
God hath not cast away his people, which he foreknew.
That's a little low.
So the question boils down to this. What did happen to the millions, yes, millions of Israelites, who were driven out of Palestine 700 years before Christ? And where were they, if they existed at all, at the time Paul uttered his statement of confidence?
What do you mean,
in God
if?
Keeping his promises to Israel? Can we find out what happened to them? So
yes,
that their
can.
Descendants can be identified in the world today. For a visual answer to that question, we are going to call on E. Raymond Capp, a Bible student and biblical archaeologist from California.
Mr. Capp has traveled and studied extensively in Europe and the Mideast. He lectures on the Dead Sea Scrolls, on the pyramids of Egypt, and on other archaeological subjects. Mr.
Yeah, it was my studies into the pyramids that actually led me into Christian identity, because it turned out a lot of the authors who were writing about the Great Pyramid connected it to the Bible, and several passages, especially in Isaiah, which are actually references to the Great Pyramid, and a whole new science called pyramidology emerged from that, and virtually all of these pyramidologists were British Israel. And so reading about the Great Pyramid, I learned about British Israel, which is how I got interested in, and this is how I found Christian identity, which is the American version of British Israel. And of course, for those of you who don't know, British Israel falsely considers the Jews to be the tribe of Judah. We know that the Jews are Edomites, Canaanites, and Khazars, and Judah has no relationship to these Edomites, Canaanites, and Khazars whatsoever, nor do any of the other 11 tribes of Israel. And, okay, I got to hit the play button. Here we go.
Cap is the author of books on the Great Pyramid, on astronomy and the Bible, on Stonehenge of England and Druidism, on Solomon's Temple, on ancient Israel, and he has written an excellent Bible study on the Abrahamic covenants. Now to Mr. Cap with our questions.
This interesting little marble head was found in the vicinity of...
And, of course, the interviewer is none other than Sheldon Emery, who I met in 1980 in central Illinois at the Christian... at a Christian Identity Conference in Flora, Illinois, as the Christian Patriots Defense League, at which Sheldon Emery taught every year. And I also met Pastor Butler and William Pierce and many others who attended those conferences. That was really great times. I thought that the white race was going to erupt and get rid of the Jews when I was attending those conferences. It was really great stuff, but here we go. Let's continue.
Ephesus in Turkey. Is that an identifiable historical figure?
Well, at the present time, we have not identified him, but we hope to do so. I would suggest he's of the Byzantine period, about the 4th or 5th century A.D.
Ray, I have read several of your books, and I've had the pleasure of sitting in on some of your lectures. As a minister, I know there is an abundance of prophecy concerning the destiny of Israel. But there is no Bible history of this portion of Israel referred to in 2 Kings 17:6. In the 9th year of Hoshea, the king of Assyria took Samaria and carried Israel away into Assyria and placed them in Halah and in Habor by the river of Gozan and in the city of the Medes. The Bible history of this major part of Israel ends here, and yet the prophets and the New Testament promise an increase in numbers, great blessings, and an eventual restoration. With the passing of 2,500 years since this Assyrian captivity, one might think that all hope of tracing these Israelites is lost. Ray, can archaeology answer this question?
Of course, archaeology can answer this question, and they're not black Hebrews, they're Aryan Hebrews. Let's continue. And this is E. Raymond Capp. He's going to give a lot of detailed information, some of which we covered last week, but let's continue.
Yes, Pastor Emery, it has. During the last 100 years, a number of archaeological teams have been working in the Middle East. They have unearthed and published the original contemporary accounts of the Syrians who took the Israelites captive. It is from these records that vital clues have come to light. In fact, these records are found in the form of cuneiform tablets, such as I show you here. These were found at Nineveh in 1900 and published in 1930. However, their relevance to Israel was overlooked then because they were found in complete disorder and amongst about 1,400 other texts. The tablets were Assyrian frontier post reports dated about 707 B.C. They describe the activities of a people called Gomera.
Now, if you click on the video, you can watch it and turn the audio down and listen to this audio. You can see the stone tablet here, or clay tablet, I forget what she said, with the inscriptions and talking about the Israelites. Let's continue.
Lived in the land of Gomera. The descriptions of Gomera.
Now, you remember from last week, Gomer is an Assyrian corruption of King Omri. King Omri, who was the king of the 10 northern tribes, the northern house of Israel. And that's where Gomer, Cimmerian, and the various versions of Omri come from. As Assyrian names, the exonymic, I think is the proper expression, the names which other people give to the Israelites at that time versus the endonymic names which the Israelites would all call themselves by, which would be Israel, Judah, and whatever tribe they happen to be part of. And so those endonymic names the Israelites carried with them in their migrations into Europe. But the vast majority of these tribes are given exonymic names by other historians. and these endonymic names have been lost. Although, for example, Jutland is obviously Judah, and Denmark is obviously Dan. Let's continue.
Here described the area the Israelites had been placed just a few years earlier. One tablet stated that when the king of Urartu came into the land of Gemir, his army was routed as the Gemira counterattacked, entered the land of Urartu and killed their commanders. Well, historians are now aware of the fact that the Gemira were the same people who, about 30 years later, during the reign of Esarhaddon, king of Assyria, were again called Gemira. We find in another and later Assyrian tablet that in the second year of the reign of this same king, which would be about 679 B.C., the Gemira, under a leader named Tuespa, sought freedom by moving north. But the Assyrian army pursued and defeated them in the upper Euphrates district. Nevertheless, they reported a large number of the Israelites escaped to the shores of the Black Sea. The Greeks also recorded the same activity, including an invasion of Sardis, the capital of Lydia, in 645 B.C. In their records, they refer to the Gemira as Kimeroi, which we translate into English as Sumerian.
Okay, I prefer to use the Greek pronunciation, which is Kimmerian. And the reason why is it's too easily confused with the term Sumerian. So Sumerian and Sumerian are so close that we might as well stick with the Greek pronunciation of Kimmerian. And that's who our ancestors were, the Kimmerians. And again, Gemira, Gamir, these are versions of King Omri. That's where all these terms originate. They originate from King Omri. And so, since I had to break in here, Nimble Horse asks, what about Zerah Judah? And I'll just go as briefly as I can here. I think I addressed this last week. Zerah Judah was, as Troublemaker says, it means breach, because it doesn't has nothing to do with the covenant. He breached the womb by sticking his hand out of the womb, and that's why the midwife tied a scarlet thread around his wrist. After she did that, he pulled his hand back into the womb, and then Phares was born first. And that's why Zerah is referred to as the breach. And Phares is, of course, the progenitor of the house of Judah in Palestine, from whom Yahshua Messiah directly descended through Judah. So that's now Zerah left with some Danites and various other members of the various tribes from Egypt around 1500 BC, while all 12 tribes were captive in Egypt. And they migrated across the Mediterranean Sea, founded Troy, founded Rome, founded the Peloponnesus, and various other colonies in the northern part of the Mediterranean, in what's today known as Greece and Italy, and also settled in Spain. That's why Spain had the original name of Iberia, which Capdwell mentioned here. So Zerah Judah, and of course the Roman emperors and the kings of Britain, the early kings of Britain, are direct descendants of Zerah Judah. Let's continue.
About 600 B.C., the Lydians drove the Gemira, or Sumerians, out of Asia Minor, where they settled in the Carpathian regions west of the Black Sea. We find them called, in the second book of Esdras, the people of Arsareth. We now also know what happened to the larger body of Gemira, or Israelites, that did not escape the Assyrians. They formed an alliance with Esarhaddon the king when he came under attack of the Medes and the Persians. This treaty allowed the Israelites to establish colonies in Cyrene in the north and Bactria in the east. With absolutely no help from the Israelites, Assyria fell in 612 B.C. Soon the Israelites themselves came under attack by the Medes. Now those that had settled in Cyrene, they moved north through the Darial Pass into the steppe regions of South Russia. There they became known by the Greek name Scythians. The Israelites that had settled in Bactria were forced north and east. And in the records of the Persians, they were called Massagetae and Saka.
And of course, Saka derives from Genesis 21:12, In Isaac shall thy seed be called. That's Yahweh speaking directly to Abraham. In other words, his descendants would be named after his son Isaac. Let's continue.
Technology has solved two of the greatest archaeological problems. First, what happened to the hundreds of thousands of Israelites who disappeared south of the Caucasus? And second, the origin of the Sumerians and the mysterious nomadic tribes known as Scythians, who suddenly...
If you're watching the video with the sound down at the 601 mark, you can see the map of the Cimmerians, Scythians, Massagete, Saka, and Israelites being to the south of the Black Sea. So you can see that all three migration routes that the Israelites took, but the main one was the Pass of Israel through the Caucasus Mountains. And you can see on the left, the west of the Black Sea is the Bosporus, which is a very narrow channel separating Turkey from Europe, okay? And then, I forget the name of the sea now, the one east of the Black Sea. The one to the far right is the Sea of Azov, but I can't remember the name of the sea between the Sea of Azov and the Black Sea. Anyway, to the east of that, that's where the Saka. Now, all of these people are Israelites. All of Caspian. Thank you, John. So we have the Black Sea, the Caspian Sea, and the Sea of Azov. And, of course, to the west of that is the big Mediterranean Sea. All of these are freshwater seas, except for the Mediterranean, of course, which is saltwater. And the Black Sea used to be freshwater before the Strait of the Bosporus opened up and the seawater began to spill in to the Black Sea, because the Black Sea was once a freshwater lake. This map shows the three main migration routes north of the Israelites around the Black Sea and the Caspian Sea. And there may have been some to the east of the Sea of Azov as well. And all these people are identified with the Israelites, no doubt about it. Let's continue.
They appeared north of the Caucasus, both the same time in history. They were one and the same people. They were Israelites. Now may I point out what the Bible has to say concerning these same people. I'm reading now from Amos 9.
Okay, for some reason, TalkShoe will not allow me to post a link twice. somebody, I think Campchar is asking for the link to be posted again. So, our Celtic Warrior, somebody else will have to do it. I cannot do it. I have no idea why TalkShoe will not allow me to post a link more than once. But let's continue.
Verse 9. For lo, I
Amos
will command,
verse 9.
And will sift the house of Israel among all nations, like as corn is sifted in the sieve. Yet shall not the least grain fall upon the earth. Our history books pick up the story at this point, recording the westward migrations of the Scythians as they came into collision with the Sumerians, who had earlier settled west
Cimmerians,
of the Black
he
Sea.
Means.
Their kinship lost over the centuries. The ensuing battles forced the Sumerians west and north to become the Celts, Gauls, and Cimbri.
Okay, I disagree with that first statement. The Cimmerians did not become Celts. The Celts were already there. The Celts, the Celtic and Gaelic migration was part of Zarajuda. The Celts were in Central Europe long before the Cimmerian migration. Basically, you have three migrations. First, the one I just mentioned, the Zarajuda. Zarajuda from Egypt around 1500 BC, which settled Greece and Rome and Spain, and they actually migrated up to Ireland and England. In fact, Brutus, who was a Roman Israelite, a direct descendant of Zarajuda, founded London, okay? And then around 800 to 600 BC, then you have the Cimmerian migration, which also included the two daughters of Zedekiah, Skada and Tiatefi. They both went through Egypt at Tapanis and then through Spain. And Tiatefi moved all the way to Ireland, where she married Jochide, who was of Zerah Judah, thereby bringing the Zerah Judah branch, intermarrying with the Pharez Judah branch, bringing the two branches of Judah back together, and your British and Irish kings and queens. That's how the two sticks of Judah got back together. So let's continue with Cap.
By the end of the 4th century B.C., the Scythians had established themselves as the great and prosperous kingdom of Scythia. Later, the Sarmatians, these were a mixed non-Israelite people of Iranian origin, they in turn drove the Scythians northwest to the shores of the Baltic Sea. At this time in history, we find the Romans introduced the name German in place of the name Scythian, in order not to confuse the Scythians with the Sarmatians now who occupied Scythia. Germanus being the Latin name for genuine.
Now, the Sarmatians are a bit of a mystery. I believe that they're a mixture of Slavs and Israelites, because the Slavs, of course, are the descendants of Japheth. There's some people suggest that the Sarmatians had some Oriental blood in them too. I'm not sure about that, but I think the Sarmatians are a blending of Japheth and the Shemitic Israelites. Let's continue.
The Germans were the genuine Scythians. During this time, the Celts...
All right, all you Germans, you're genuine. That's what the word German means. It means genuine, authentic, real, not fake, real.
They're expanding in all directions from Central Europe. Some of the Celts moved into Spain and became known as Iberians, the Gaelic name for Hebrews.
Okay, as I said earlier, the people of Zerah Judah were in Spain long before this. We're talking, this is 400 B.C., something like that, and the Zerah Judah was in Spain around 1400 B.C. already, and that's because the Iberia is the oldest name for Spain, much older than any other name given to that peninsula called Spain today.
Poured into Britain to form the bedrock of the British race. Later, the Iberians moved into Ireland as Scots, and later into northern Britain to establish the nation of Scotland. Your history books all...
And, of course, Scotland is named after Skada, one of the two daughters of Zedekiah.
...also record the Germanic tribes breaking up into many divisions, the Angles, Saxons, Jutes, Danes, and Vikings, to name just a few. Other Germanic tribes later poured into the lands vacated by the Celts and established the Gothic nations for the Vandals, Lombards, Franks, Burgundians, and others. The so-called lost tribes of Israel were really never lost. They only lost their identity as they migrated westward over the centuries from the land of their captivity.
And there you have it, my friends. Mr. Cap has given us a visual answer to our question. What happened to the millions of Israelites who were dispersed out of old Canaan land 7 centuries before Christ and who never returned? They migrated onto the continent of Europe and were the ancestors of the white European race. And in answering our question about Israel's disappearance, Mr. Cap has given us the key to several other mysteries of world history. Mr. Cap has revealed to us why it was these European people who became the great nations and who were blessed by God above all other nations, not only with fertile land and abundance from the seas, but with arts, science, literature, inventions, and discovery.
And of course, the Jews have none of these things. Yes, the apostles were all Benjaminites. Even Paul was a Benjaminite. So that's why Benjamin was attached to Judah. And that's why Galilee was north of Judea, where these were simple, you know, they were fishermen, farmers, etc. They were not citified, Judeans that were constantly intermingling with the Pharisaic Edomites. So the Benjamites were pure-blooded tribe of Benjamin.
God bestowed upon that one race almost every invention and discovery that has improved man's condition and lot upon the earth. Certainly God made these offspring of Abraham a blessing to all the families of the earth.
That's right. Okay. That's it. It's not very long. So 9.5 minutes. It's an outstanding video from Sheldon Emery and E. Raymond Capt. So this is the kind of stuff. It's all over the internet. We just have to search for it and find it. So now I'm going to switch to a written document, and it's going to be, okay, for some reason it's not popping up. Hold on. Okay. I've got to go back and find the link I had to, actually I posted it in the chat room earlier, so maybe I can find it and just open it up that way. I think it was the very first link I put in. Christian Identity Forum. Okay, I just clicked on that. It's a good thing I put it into the chat room. The Complete Works of Bertrand Comparé. And you'll see the slide bar on the right. It's a gray rectangle. If you slide that down, all the way down to, oops, I went too far, page 81. I'm at 79. Page 81. Historic Proof of Israel's Migrations by Bertrand L. Comparé. And he says, in my lecture called Israel's Fingerprints, I have sketched briefly for you some of the Bible's evidence that the Anglo-Saxon, Scandinavian, and Germanic people of today are the living descendants of the Israel of the Bible. This evidence was in the form of many Bible prophecies of Israel's future, which have been accurately fulfilled by these nations and by no others. That is, of course, the European white nations. If the people who have actually done all the things which God said Israel would do, and who have received the exact blessings which God said he would give to Israel, if they are not Israel, how could God be so greatly mistaken? Well, because the Jews have never fulfilled any of his prophecies, and the Jews have never blessed the earth like the descendants of Abraham have. He continues, no, God was not mistaken. He knew what he would do and for whom he would do it. By making good all his prophecies and promises, he has identified these nations as Israel. That's, of course, the European nations and the various offshoot nations such as America, Canada, New Zealand, Australia, South Africa, etc. But there are some people that won't believe God and will not accept his identification of these nations. In fact, one clergyman with whom I discussed this, a minister of a church in this country, wrote to me demanding to know what other historians of the time, in what books, chapters, and verses, record their migrations into Northern and Western Europe and the British Isles. He is but one of many skeptics who asked this, and to these skeptics the answer is yes, various historians of those centuries have traced various steps of this migration. I can only say that the British Israel library, for the lack of a better term, the volumes which must go into the thousands of books by British Israel authors verifying the migrations. There's literally thousands of titles, but they're all suppressed. And I have a collection of many of these books in my library, but of course the Jews have destroyed many of these books, and the ones they haven't destroyed, they are suppressing. And this was actually common knowledge up until, I'd say, World War I, when the Jews began to change the political landscape. Even Queen Victoria herself believed in the British Israel doctrine, so that and she was a direct descendant of King David. So, and then there are other historians. I mean, we're talking about ancient historians, such as Bede and the Greek and Roman historians. They tell the same story. All you have to do is connect the dots between the new names, the exonymic names for Israel versus the endonymic names that the Israelites gave themselves. Once you establish a connection, and last week we established that connection totally and accurately with the, I think it was the Taylor Prism, which was in three different languages. One was Assyrian, another was Babylonian, and I forget, I think the third was a Semitic, Aramaic, or something like that. And so it gave us the three different versions of the word Israel in those writings, which proves that they're the same people. Let's continue. What I propose to do for you now is to trace this migration historically. Remember that within the time limits which must necessarily be fixed on such a talk as this, I can only hit the high spots. You know how large a library can be filled with history books, so I can't quote them all verbatim, but I will have time enough to show you that the historians have traced this migration from Israel's old Palestine home into the European homes as the Anglo-Saxon, Scandinavian, and Germanic peoples. Not under their old names, of course. Of course, the Bible says you will be known as by a new name. All right, you will be known by a new name. So, and of course, the most common one is Christian, and only the Israelites can be Christians. And of course, the Anglo-Saxon, and Isaac shall thy seed be called. There's another new name for Israel. And Germani, meaning the, and of course, the Germans, for them, it's Deutsch, Teutons. And the exonymic name for Germany by most of the European Romance languages is Alemann. The Germans are known as Alemann by most Europeans, etc., etc. Not under their old names, of course, but that also is the fulfillment of God's prophecy that he would call his servants by another name. Surely you now know that the Bible identifies Israel and only Israel as God's servants. The migration of the Israelites covered about 12 centuries, during which time they were mentioned by various historians, writing in different languages, during different centuries, so therefore mentioned under different names. Even today, if you were to read a London newspaper, a Paris newspaper, and a Berlin newspaper, all dated about the end of 1940, you would find that the British newspaper said that in that year France was invaded by the Germans. The French newspaper said that the invasion was by Le Allemand, and the German newspaper said that the invasion was by the Deutsch. Yet all three were talking about the same people and the same invasion. Likewise, we must not be surprised to find that the Israelites were given different names in the Assyrian, Greek, and Latin languages. Likewise, even in the same language, names change from century to century, just as today we never speak of Bohemia, as it was called a century ago, but only of Czechoslovakia. You remember that the original 12-tribe nation of Israel broke up into two nations upon the death of King Solomon about 975 BC. The northern two-thirds of the land containing the 10 tribes kept the name Israel, while the southern one-third, containing the tribes of Benjamin and Judah, with many of the Levites, took the name of Judah after the royal tribe. There were also many Levites that accompanied the 10 northern tribes as well. From that time on, they kept their separate existence until they were finally merged into a vast migration, as we will see. Most of the kings of the 10-tribe northern kingdom of Israel were distinguished for more for their wickedness than for any ability. Well, from the very beginning, the 10 northern tribes, the house of Israel, the house of Ephraim, they became pagans. They began at Shechem and various other places throughout Samaria, Samaria being the capital city. They erected pagan tabernacles and altars and worshiped various pagan gods. Now, the southern house of Judah did this also, but not to the same extent. The entire 10-tribe northern house of Israel became pagan. However, Omri, who reigned from 885 to 874 BC, was a vigorous and able king. although as wicked as the others and his reign was considered among the other nations of Western Asia, as the foundation upon which the national identity thereafter rested. So here's the name of Omri, him being the most famous king of the Israelites. The exonymic names for Israel were based on Omri. And that's why his name, and that's where we get Gamir, Kemarioi, Kemarians, and Kumru, which is the national name of the Celts. The Welsh. The Welsh still refer to themselves as the Kumru today, and of course, that term Kumru is based on King Omri. And so no other people can have these linguistic connections between the migrating tribes and the obviously the northern European people. Let's see where my screen went blank momentarily, so I can find where I left off. Okay, however, Omri, who reigned from 885 to 874 BC, was a vigorous and able king, although he was very wicked. The nation of Israel found its itself named after him by various different peoples and in various different languages. The language of that day spoke of a family, a tribe, or even a whole nation as a house or household. If you have read your Bible much, and if you're a Judeo-Christian, you haven't read it very much. But if you're an Identian, you've read it a lot. And that's a huge difference between Christian identity and Judeo-Christians. They really don't read their Bibles, and they certainly don't do any Bible research. They can't hold a candle to us when it comes to Bible research, especially historical research. So let's continue. If you have read your Bible much, you must surely remember God's many references to the house of Israel or the kingdom of Judah. But the phrase was also used in those days to refer to a nation as the house of a great king who ruled it. The Assyrians, among others, began calling the 10-tribed kingdom of Israel the house of Omri. In Hebrew, house was Beith or Beth or Beth or Bet. In English, usually spelled Beth, B-E-T-H, pronounced Beth. In the related Semitic languages of Assyrian, this was Bit. The Hebrew Omri was in Assyrian sometimes written Humari, sometimes Kumru. And of course, Bet Liz, a Bet, is a common English name. El being God, the Hebrew name for God. And Eliz is probably a corruption of Elisha, or possibly even Elijah. So you can see that the English name Elizabeth is a combination of El and Beth, two Hebrew words. In the related Semitic languages of Assyrian, this was Bit. The Hebrew Omri was in Assyrian sometimes written Humari and sometimes Kumri. And the Assyrians had a habit of placing a K in front of words that began with a vowel. That's why Omri became Kumri. And that's why the Welsh refer to themselves even today as the Kumru. With this preface in mind, let's start tracing the Israelites from their Palestinian homeland in the Assyrian conquest and deportation. In 2 Kings 15:29, we read, quote, "In the days of Pekah, king of Israel, came Tiglath-Pileser, who was known to history as Pul, P-U-L, king of Assyria, and took Ijon and Abel-Beth-Maacah, and Genoa, and Kedesh, and Hazor, and Gilead, and Galilee." Of course, Gilead and Galilee are Hebrew names, Israelite names. "All the land of Naphtali, and carried them captive to Assyria." So here we have an independent record, archaeological record, of the capture of various Israelite towns and all the land of Naphtali. In Chronicles 5:26, it says, "And the God of Israel stirred up the spirit of Pul." Okay, here he's called Pul, same person, Tiglath-Pileser, also known as Pul, king of Assyria, and the spirit of Tiglath-Pileser, king of Assyria, and he carried them away. even the Reubenites and the Gadites and half the tribe of Manasseh, and brought them unto Halah and Habor and Hara and to the river Gozan unto this day. So here we have direct evidence from Scripture of the various tribes taken into captivity by the Assyrians. They're taken north, folks, not south into Africa, not east into Asia, and not just yet west into Europe. That comes a bit later. Confirmation of this is found in inscriptions of Tiglath-Pileser, which archaeologists have dug up and are in our museums today. One of these says, quote, "The cities of Galassa, probably Assyrian for Galilee, Abilka, probably Assyrian for Abel Beth Maaka, which are on the border of Bethumria, the whole land of Naphtali in its entirety, I brought within the border of Assyria. My official I set over them as governor." So here is direct archaeological confirmation of the statement just quoted from the Bible. The land of Bethumria, which is house of Omri. Remember your Hebrew? Beth is house, the house of Omri, Bethumria. All of its people together with all their goods I carried off to Assyria. Pahaka, their king, that is Pekah, they deposed, and I place Asi as their king. Hosea. I think both houses, Judah and Israel, had a king named Hosea, I'm pretty sure. Anyway, unquote. In confirmation of this change in kings, we read in 2 Kings 15:30, quote, "And Hoshea, the son of Elah, made a conspiracy against Pekah, son of Remaliah, and smote him and slew him and reigned in his stead." It's very important to understand that the northern tribes of Israel are not reckoned in the king lists because they were so evil. They were all, every last one of them, pagans. And that's why Yahweh had them taken into captivity. Now, as I said earlier, the house of Judah was not much better. But at least the house of Judah had righteous kings, had several, in fact, many righteous kings. The house of Israel did not have a single righteous king. Every last one of them was a pagan. Continuing, "The conquest thus has begun in the northeastern and northern parts of the kingdom about 740 BC, then worked southward down to the heavily fortified capital city of Samaria, which was captured about 721 BC. And I have listed a record that Tiglath-Pileser carried off the eastern half of the tribe of Manasseh starting in 745 BC. 745 BC was the first year of the deportations. And Comparé dates the 740 BC, but it doesn't mention the half-tribe of Manasseh, which was living on the east side of the Jordan River. Let's continue. "Another king of Assyria reigned by that time." 2 Kings 18, 9-11 records it as follows, quote, "And it came to pass in the fourth year of King Hezekiah of Judah, which was the seventh year of Hoshea, son of Elah, king of Israel, that Shalmaneser, king of Assyria, came up against Samaria and besieged it. And at the end of 3 years they took it, even in the sixth year of Hezekiah, that is, the ninth year of Hoshea, king of Israel, Samaria was taken. And the king of Israel, Assyria, did carry away Israel, that is, the house of Israel, unto Assyria, and put them in Halah and Habor by the river of Gozan and in the cities of the Medes." And of course, the audio and video of E. Raymond Capt shows on the map exactly this, shows this exactly. Let's continue. "We know that King Shalmaneser died toward the latter part of this siege, and the final conquest and deportation were carried on by his successor, King Sargon II. In confirmation of this, an inscription of Sargon II says, quote, "In the beginning of my reign, the city of Samaria I besieged, I captured 27,280 of its inhabitants I carried away," and these were not black Nubians, folks. All the records prove that they were blue-eyed and many of them blonde-haired. Of course, there are red-haired Israelites and there's dark-haired Israelites. Not all of them are blonde. But the Anglo-Saxons had already figured out a way of dyeing their hair blonde even before Roman times. And that's why Julius Caesar referred to them as angels, because they looked like angels with their blonde hair and blue eyes. Continuing, the deportation of a whole nation naturally took a considerable period of time. The journey had to be organized with adequate supplies for each convoy and each stage of the journey, and proper organization of the places selected to receive them. We know that Sargon II did not hold the cities of the Medes east of the Zagros Mountains until a few years later, after 721 BC. So about 715 to 712 BC is the correct date for the deportation to Media. The places to which Israel was deported by the Assyrians can be summed up in brief as constituting an arc or semicircles around the southern end of the Caspian Sea. And of course, not just the southern end, but all the way across the southern end of the Black Sea as well. Because the Israelites actually migrated across the Bosporus, where the Black Sea, you know, meets up with the Mediterranean Sea. And then we said also the Sea of Azov, as that map showed, the Israelites migrated through all three of those places and probably east of the Sea of Azov as well. Let's continue. This deportation took in the entire population of the 10 northern tribes constituting the nation of Israel. Well, that's hard to say. I can't say that all of those Israelites left. Probably most did. It was certainly in the millions. From this point on, the separation into tribes is apparently lost, and it is as a nation that the Kingdom of Israel moved into its Assyrian captivity. Now, the modern name for that entire area south of the Caspian Sea and south of the Black Sea is Armenia. That is called Armenia today. And many of those people in Armenia are actually white, and they're probably descendants of the tribes, those Israelites, who did not migrate. That's why they're white. Okay? Let's continue. This left the other two tribes still living in the southern kingdom of Judah. Assyria and Egypt were the two giant empires of that day, each seeking domination over all the smaller and weaker nations. Assyria had driven Egyptian influence out of Western Asia back to the continent of Africa and had made all the smaller nations surrounding Judah into vassal states, paying heavy tribute to Assyria. Now, the Egyptians were white too, because they're descendants of Ham, who was a white man, not a Negro. The brutal and rapacious character of the Assyrians made them no friends, and their vassal states were always hopefully looking for any means of escape from Assyrian power. Egypt kept the hope of revolt alive by offers of military assistance to those who would rebel against Assyria. The death of a king seemed the most opportune time for revolt, since his successor would need time to get his power organized and might even face some competition at home for his throne. Therefore, when King Sargon II of Assyria died about 705 BC, revolts began in Western Asia, the kingdom of Judah under King Hezekiah taking part in it, in the hope of military aid from Egypt, although the prophet Isaiah warned that the revolt would fail. The new king of Assyria, Sennacherib, set about recovering his empire. One rebellious city after another was reconquered with the hideous cruelty characteristic of Assyria. In 701 BC, Sennacherib's huge army invaded the kingdom of Judah. Midway through it, they paused briefly to defeat the Egyptian army, then moved on to besiege Jerusalem. None of the smaller cities of Judah were able to resist. 2 Kings 18:13 and Isaiah 36:1 say that, quote, in the 14th year of King Hezekiah, of Judah, of course, Sennacherib came up against all the fortified cities of Judah and captured them, but not Jerusalem. Then followed the siege of Jerusalem, which was ended when the angel of Yahweh killed 185,000 Assyrians soldiers in one night. And Sennacherib gave up the siege and fled back to his own land. So here is Yahweh protecting Judah so that Yahshua the Messiah would come from Judah. Let's continue. In confirmation of this, Sennacherib's own record of this says, quote, I then besieged Hezekiah of Judah, who had not submitted to my yoke, and I captured 46 of his strong cities and fortresses and innumerable small cities which were round about them, with the battering of rams and the assault of engines and the attack of foot soldiers. Here again is archaeological confirmation of the Bible. And by mines and breaches made in the walls, I brought out there from 200,150 people, both small and great, that is, both rich and poor. Hezekiah himself, like a caged bird, I shut up within Jerusalem, his royal city. That is, that's a spin way of saying that I did not capture Hezekiah or Jerusalem. Ancient kings were boastful of their victories, but never of their defeats. So King Sennacherib tactfully fails to state how the siege of Jerusalem ended. But he does confirm the capture of all the other cities of Judah and the deportation of 200,000 people. Remember that all the people of the 10 northern tribes were already settled around the south end of the Caspian Sea and the south end of the Black Sea in the Assyrian deportation of Israel. Now to them was added a large portion of the two southern tribes of Benjamin and Judah, and that is absolutely correct. All 12 tribes were taken into captivity by the Assyrians. So when Yahshua says, "I come not but unto the lost," that is the exiled sheep of the house of Israel, it includes the Benjamin and Judah. Let's continue. These were the people who became your ancestors and mine when they moved into Europe. They never moved into Africa, folks. They never moved into Asia, although there were offshoot groups of Israelites, Scythians, and Japhethites that did go into Asia, into Mongolia. They're called the Tukharians. They even went as far as Japan. And the word Japan actually comes from Japheth or Japheth. The nation of Japan is actually named after Japheth. Over the years, the increasing numbers of the Israelite tribes expanded northward along both sides of the Caspian Sea. They were not basically the city builders, but farmers and herdsmen. Probably in the earlier part of their stay here, the Assyrians sternly discouraged the building of cities which would naturally be fortified centers of resistance. Well, the Assyrians discouraged the Israelites from building their own cities, but they were using the Israelites as slaves for their own construction projects, such as the city of Nineveh. As they were moved into this area, herded along as prisoners, robbed of all their belongings, they had to make themselves brush shelters or booths where they stopped for any length of time. Here in the southwest, our Indians call such brushy shelter a wikiup. The Hebrews called it a sukkah, applying the name also to a tent, or sukkoth, yeah, which he mentions next. It was the only house a nomad owned. The plural of sukkah was sukkoth. Gradually, this was slurred over into south, used of a tent dweller or nomad, and finally became Scythian. And of course, sukkoth is a booth, a tabernacle. That's what that means in the Hebrew. Festival of booths is the festival of sukkoth, or tents. The great carving on the Behistun rock, made about 516 BC, carried inscriptions showing the many different nations who were tributary to the king Darius I of Persia. These inscriptions were written in Old Persian, in Median, and Assyrian. They showed that among these were a Scythian nation called in Assyrian and Babylonian Gimiri, which means the tribes. From Gimiri, and I think this is a corruption again of King Omri, from Gimiri was derived the name of Kimmerians. There you go, that's King Omri, who settled somewhat to the north and into the Ukraine. But the Behistun inscriptions also stated that these people were called Saka in Persian and Median. Already the later names are beginning to evolve. So Gimiri, Scythian, Saka, Kimmerian, these are all new names for the Israelites. The great Greek historian Herodotus, who lived from 484 to 425 BC and was generally called the father of history, speaking of these people, says, quote, "The Sakae, or Scyths, were clad in trousers and had on their heads tall, steel caps rising to a point. I talked about these sharp-pointed, tall caps looking much like a wizard's cap that the Saka, the Israelites of the day, wore. They bore on the bow of their country and the dagger, okay, which would be the longbow, I guess. So bow and arrows, in other words, besides which they carried the battle axe or sagaris. Now, the Israelites were exclusive in carrying the battle axe. As far as I'm aware, no other nation ever carried the battle axe. So here we're seeing that the Sakai, the Siths, Gemiri, all descendants of the 12 tribes, continue the Israelite tradition of carrying a battle axe into combat. They were, in truth, Emergian Scythians, but the Persians called them Sakai, since that is the name which they gave to all Scythians. That's Herodotus speaking. Incidentally, some of the magnificent carved walls of the ancient ruins of the Persian palace at Persepolis show illustrations of those Sakai in their trousers and pointed caps, bringing tribute to the Persian king. And we talked about this last time, the inscriptions on the wall showing very much Aryan-looking people, not hooked nose, receding forehead, ugly Jews. We are now getting further clues to these people. Herodotus says that the Scythians or Sakai first appeared in that land in the 7th century B.C., which is the same period in which the tribes of Israel were settled there by their Assyrian conquerors. Their use of the battle axe as a weapon is a carryover from their history as Israel. In Jeremiah 51:20, God says of Israel, quote, "Thou art my battle axe and weapons of war, for with thee will I break in pieces the nations, and with thee will I destroy kingdoms." And that's what our people have done until these latter days when Edom, Esau, has the dominion over us until the judgment day. We will see later that the name evolved from Saka to Saxon, and it is noteworthy that the battle axe was the great weapon of the Saxons. These Scythians or Sakai lived up to God's description of Israel as his battle axe and weapons of war. They became a military people of great power who did much to break up ancient nations. They were also seafarers and they were pirates going up and down the coast of Europe. The Greek geographer and historian Strabo, who lived between 63 BC, I believe Strabo was actually a German, not a Greek, who lived between 63 BC and about 21 AD, says, quote, "Most of the Scythians beginning from the Caspian Sea are called Dahe Scythae." Dahe would probably be a corruption of the tribe of Dan. "And those situated more toward the east, Massagete," there's your tribe of Manasseh, "and Sakai. The rest have the common name of Scythians," which again is Hebrew for booths, corruption of the word for Hebrew word for booths or tents. "But each tribe has its own peculiar name. The Sakai made incursions similar to those of the Cimmerians and Trares, some near their own country, others at a greater distance. They occupied Bactriana and got possession of the most fertile tract of Armenia, which was called after their own name, Sakasin." Okay, so the original name of Armenia was Sakasin, namely the country of the Saxons. All right, guest 18, you don't know the difference between a Jew and a Judahite. That's what you don't know. Stop speaking rubbish. Okay, let's continue. From this point on, I'll see. This was but partly, I'm lost my place looking over to the chat room here. This is great stuff. Okay, they advanced even as far as the Cappadocians, those particularly situated near the Black Sea, who are now called Pontici. This was but the early part of their expansion. When a century had elapsed since their deportation to this land of Scythia, they had grown strong enough to begin the long series of harassing wars against their conquerors, the Assyrians. Now, of course, we also have to bear in mind that the Parthians are descendants of some of these tribes, and the Parthians had Benjamites and Parthian Judahites as their leaders and had Levites. The Magi were Parthians, Israelites of Judah, Benjamin, and Levi. When a century had elapsed since their deportation to this land of Scythia, they had grown strong enough to begin a long series of harassing wars against their conquerors, the Assyrians. They lacked the strength to capture the powerfully fortified group of cities about the Assyrian capital, and in turn, their nomadic habits make it easy for them to retreat before a too powerful Assyrian army. But generations of this constant warfare wore down the Assyrians, bled them white, so that when the Medes finally overran Assyria and captured Nineveh in 612 BC, their victory was fairly easy against the exhausted Assyrians. Now, also, I have to point out that our ancestors here, these Saxons and Scythians, were known as tremendous horsemen and archers. These mounted archers were so good at their warfare tactics that they would devastate any army that tried to invade them. How did they do this? And even the Greek armies were devastated by these Saxon archers. What they did was they simply rode circles around the infantry of the invading army. And so it was actually our Israelite ancestors, not the American Indians, who invented the tactic of riding their horses around a bunch of, let's call them, pioneers, Greek pioneers in this case. And from a distance, they would shoot their arrows into the encampment or into the body of Greek soldiers or whatever soldiers they might have been. This went into the days of Rome as well. And they would just pick them off with their arrows. And any soldier who tried to come out from that formation would easily be picked off by the arrow. So they simply rode around this the enemy and picked them off with their arrows. Now, the only general who was able to fight against these, Isaiah says, Alexander the Great. And Alexander did was he encountered a Scythian army near a river. So what he did was he ordered his men to march toward the river, thereby cutting through the circle of the Scythian archers, and that ended the route. So from that point on, Alexander the Great used that tactic whenever he encountered the Scythian archers, and other people caught on and started to use that tactic. But out in the open field, there was nothing they could do against the Scythian, that is, Saxon Israelite archers. And of course, at this time too, the Parthians were the ones who wore chainmail. It tells us that Judah wore chainmail. These are your Teutonic Knights. The origin of knighthood was right here in Parthia among the Scythian Saxons. They're the ones who invented the knight in shining armor. And that tradition was carried by the Israelites, of course, into Europe. From this point on, I could refer you to just one historical work which fully traces the Scythians on their settlement in England as the Anglo-Saxons. A History of the Anglo-Saxons by Sharon Turner does a magnificent job of this, although Sharon Turner doesn't realize that they're Israelites. That's the only drawback of that book. As most of you know, I am a lawyer by profession. A lawyer soon learns to distinguish between the man who actually knows the facts and the man who is merely repeating hearsay, that is, gossip and rumor he has heard from others. How do we know whether these others actually know what they are talking about? Unless a man has seen the occurrence with his own eyes, his ideas on the subject are no better than the accuracy of the information he has received. However, folks, most history is hearsay. But the interesting thing here is we can trace the migrations of these people and the reports of all these different historians, German, Greek, Roman, and other historians, all tell us the same story, that the Anglo-Saxon people began in Armenia. They began in Armenia, and we can even trace our DNA. European DNA, R1B1, traces to Armenia, the exact location where the 12 tribes of Israel were before heading into Europe. Even our DNA proves it. Let us go back to the Scythians. As the people of Israel became known in the land to which they were deported, Diodorus Siculus, a Greek historian who lived in the times of Julius and Augustus Caesar, says this: "The Scythians anciently enjoyed but a small tract of ground, but through their valor, growing stronger by degrees, they enlarged their dominion far and near and attained at last to a vast and glorious empire which actually includes Parthia, folks, actually includes Parthia. At the first, a very few of them and the Parthians fought the Romans to a standstill. The Romans could not defeat the Parthians." There's very, very few history books that even talk about the Parthians because the Jews don't want you to know that the Parthians were Judah. "At the first, a very few of them, and those very despicable for their mean origin, seated themselves near to the river Araxes." Of course, this is a Roman historian saying that our ancestors were despicable. "Afterwards," and then they started calling us barbarians. We're the real barbarians were the Romans. "Afterwards, one of their ancient kings, who was a warlike prince and skillful in arms, gained to their country all the mountainous parts as far to Mount Caucasus." Whoa! Mount Caucasus, how about that? "Some time afterwards, their posterity, becoming famous and eminent for valor and martial affairs, subdued many territories." Here's the Roman Greek Diodorus Siculus is confirming our migrations. "Then, turning their arms the other way, they led their forces as far as to the river Nile in Egypt." So some of them, this would be the Parthians. "Other historians record that blonde Scythians made an expedition against Palestine and Egypt about 626 BC. The town of Scythopolis in the Jordan Valley is named for a settlement on this raid, and they stayed there. That's why it was named Scythopolis. In other words, these Scythians, Israelites, came back to Palestine and resettled the town of Scythopolis. But to continue with Diodorus Siculus, he wrote, quote, "This nation prospered more and more and had kings that were very famous, from whom the Sakans and the Massagete," and this is where Gete comes from. The Massagete, and Gete is simply short for Massagete. And the Goths, that's where the term Goth comes from. Gotisch, that's the German Gott, God, God's people. Only the Israelites ever referred to themselves as God's people. The Gothic people are God's people. Says the Israelites referred to themselves as God's people from the very beginning. There were the Massagete and the Arimaspians. That's a new one on me. Arimaspians. And many others called by other names derived their origin from amongst others. There were two remarkable colonies that were drawn out of the conquered nations by those kings. The one they brought out of Assyria and settled in the country lying between Paphlagonia and Pontus. The other was drawn out of Media, which they placed near the river Tanae, which people called Sauromatian. So I think here is the distinction between the Scythians and the Sarmatians. As I said, I don't think that they're mixed blood. I think they're a combination of Japhetic Scythians and Shemitic Israelites. Let's continue. Note how God's destiny for these people worked. They would not leave behind any pockets of their people in the lands where their conquerors had settled them. But when they had gained great power, they came back and picked up any who remained, taking them into the migrating mass. Likewise, history records that they raided Babylon after its overthrow by the Medes and Persians, carrying off with them such of the people of Judah and Benjamin as were not going back to Jerusalem. Very good. These people would become Parthia. Even in early times, before the final mass movement into Europe, the Scythians had begun their march into their new homelands, where some of them had already arrived before the beginning of the Christian era. Pliny the Elder, a Roman historian who lived from 23 to 79 AD, says this, quote, "The name Scythian has extended in every direction, even to the Sarmatae and the Germans. But this ancient name is now only given to those who dwell beyond those nations and live unknown to nearly all the rest of the world. In other words, they distinguish the Sarmatae and the Germans from the other Scythians who stayed behind and still occupy that territory. Beyond the Danube are the peoples of Scythia. Of course, we know that our people migrated west along the Danube River, which is named after the tribe of Dan. And other tribes sailed along with the Danites, who were the scout tribe. And the Danites went so far as Sweden and became known as Vikings. The Persians have called them by the general name of Sake, which properly belongs only to the nearest nation of them. The more ancient writers give them the name of Arami, that is Aramaeans, and that's the language they spoke. The multitude of these Scythians is quite innumerable. In their life and their habits, they much resemble the people of Parthia. There you go, there's Parthia. The tribes among them that are better known are the Sake, the Massagete, the Dahe, etc., etc. So here, these sub-tribes of the Israelites retain some semblance of their tribal names or their sub-tribal names, like the sons of, for example, Benjamin. One of the sons of Benjamin was Rosh, which can be corrupted into Rus for Rusland or Russia. Others have noted this early migration into Germany. For example, Herodotus mentions a migration and settlement of a people he calls Sigino, who themselves claimed to be colonists from Media and who migrated as far as the river Rhine. Remember that among the places the Israelites were resettled were the cities of the Medes. Also note that Pliny the Elder said, quote, "The more ancient writers give them the name of Arami, that is Aramaean, in modern language called Syrian. In Deuteronomy 26:5, every Israelite was commanded to confess that, quote, a Syrian ready to perish was my father, and they're Shemites. And he went, and the Syrians were known as the whitest of the white. And he went down into Egypt and sojourned there with a few and became a nation, great, mighty, populous. Hence, such ancient writers could correctly identify the Israelite Scythians as Aramaeans, for they had come from a land which was part of Syria. Among the tribes of the Scythians, the Massagete attracted the notice of all the ancient historians by their numbers and warlike ability. Again, we were Yahweh's battle axe until Judeo-Christianity vasectomized the males of our species. Those who describe in more detail divided them into the Massagete and Thisagete. The Gete part of the name soon evolved into Goth. The Massagete were the greater Goths, and the Thisagete were the lesser Goths. And of course, this also changed to Visigoth and Ostrogoth. Visigoth meaning West Goth and Ostrogoth meaning East Goth. Thus, we already find among the Scythians names we can identify as the people who later conducted the great migrations into Europe. The Goths, as we know, were later called Ostrogoths meaning East Goths and Visigoths meaning West Goths. Now, to go back a few centuries, the Sake were allies of the Medes and Persians in the attack upon Babylon in 536 BC. Remember that Yahweh had said that Israel was my battle axe and weapons of war. For with thee will I break in pieces the nations, and with thee will I destroy kingdoms. And of course, this our people carried out into colonial times. Again, we're the only people, we in identity are the only people who understand the prophecy that Isaac made to Esau, that the day would come when you will have the dominion over your brother Jacob. And that occurred when the house of Rothschild began its destruction of the Israelite nations around 1815, right after the Battle of Waterloo, and with their establishment of the international banking system under the Bank of England. Let's continue. So God had used Scythian Israel to maintain constant war against Assyria for nearly a century until Assyria was too weakened to resist the Medes and Persians. Then God used Scythian Israel, the Sakae, to help in the conquest of Babylon when its time had come. Later, King Cyrus of Persia was foolish enough to try to conquer his former allies, the Sakae, but he was killed in the battle. King Darius also tried to conquer them, but they, being a nomadic people, retreated before his massive armies until he gave up and retired. Something to be said for a nomadic army. Professor George Rawlinson says that the original development of the Indo-European language took place in Armenia, which you will remember was at that time occupied by Scythian Israel. And you also remember that Abraham had, I forget the number of sons now. I think it was five or six sons through Keturah who were sent east. Where'd they go? They went to India, folks. They were Indian Israelites, and there they developed the language of India. Sanskrit. Sanskrit, Hebrew, Parthian, Aramaic, German, English are all Hebrew languages. Okay, so certainly from these people we can trace the introduction of this language into Europe, Indo-European, of which, of course, Sanskrit, German, Hebrew, French, all the Romance languages, Celtic, Welsh, they're all part of the same family. The so-called scholars of the universities deliberately exclude Hebrew only because they don't know that the Jews aren't Hebrews. If they knew that the Hebrews were really Aryans, they wouldn't have made such a stupid mistake. Let's continue. This powerful and increasingly numerous people thereafter spread further north, both east and west of the Caspian Sea. To the west of it, they penetrated into the Volga and Don River valleys as the Sarmatians and the Royal Scyths, nomadic peoples. To reach these lands, they had come up through the Caucasus Mountains by a great pass, which is today occupied by the Georgian Military Road. Perhaps the communists have changed the name of this pass in recent years, but from ancient times until within our own lifetimes, this pass was known as the Pass of Israel. And if you go to Anglo-Saxon Israel and look at the Migration Chronicles slideshow, there are several photographs of this pass as part of the slideshow. The white race of Europe is often called Caucasian because the ancestors of many of them did thus come out of the Caucasus Mountains. Amen. And so, as you know, I have often said, what in the world is the origin of the Caucasian people? Did they fall out of the sky? Did they materialize out of thin air? Where'd they come from? Well, they appeared on the north side of the Caucasus Mountains at the same time that the Israelites left from the south side of the Caucasus Mountains. Duh! When Alexander the Great began his great marauding expedition across Western Asia and as far as India, he had to skirt the edge of the lands held by the Scythians. In his limitless vanity and ambition, he wanted also to conquer them. But it is recorded that their ambassadors said that they would never surrender to him, that they were nomadic peoples who, if they could not resist, could retreat indefinitely before his armies. And also they had the archers, the cavalry archers. They had no wealthy cities for him to conquer and loot. They had still been nomads for quite some time, had not built their own cities, and were slaves to the Assyrians for a very long time. Alexander invaded their lands long enough to fight one severe battle with them, defeating the Scythian forces he met. But this was evidently just a lesson to them not to attack the flanks of his forces, for he led his forces out of their territory and never returned to the attack. As I said, the Israelite archers, the Scythian archers, decimated several of his generals' armies. Remember that Israel is God's battle axe and weapons of war. They had already weakened Assyria and, as allies of the Medes and Persians, had helped overthrow Assyria and Babylon. They had beaten off attempts of the Persians to conquer them. In the article Scythians, Chambers' Encyclopedia records that the Scythians, after about 128 BC, overran Persia, routed several Persian armies, and levied tribute from the Persian kings. During the first century before and the first century after Christ, hordes of Scythians, having overthrown the Bactrian and Indo-Greek dynasties of Afghanistan and India, invaded northern India, and there they maintained themselves with varying fortune for five centuries longer. The Jats of India, the Jats of India and the Rajputs have both been assigned the Scythian ancestry. Madison Grant writes that ancient Bactria maintained its Nordic and Aryan aspect long after Alexander's time and did not become Mongolized and received the sinister name of Turkestan until the 7th century AD. The Sakha were the blonde peoples who carried the Aryan language to India. The Sakha were, in fact, not just descendants of the Scythians, but also of Abraham, the Indo-Aryans, through his second wife, Keturah. Okay, let's see. A land so vast, how much do we have? About 10 minutes left. A land so vast and not the original home of the Israelite Scythians, but already having some inhabitants when they were settled there, must of course show varying types of people. Well, all of the same family, however, right? As we know, all of the same Israelite family, with a smattering of Japhetic, because let's face it, folks, the Greeks began as an offshoot of Japheth. That's how Greece began. Of course, Greece was conquered by our migrating Israelite ancestors. So was Rome. So the Zara Judah originators of Rome and Troy and Iberia, they were eventually conquered by the later migrations by the Cimmerians and by the Anglo-Saxons. All three migrations stemming from Israelite tribes. Okay, so the Nordic or Aryan Israelite Scythians conquered these other races. While some speak of a Mongoloid type found in some parts of Scythia, ancient writers pretty well agree that the dominant Sakha or Massagete Scythians were a Nordic people, and that could be where you get the Aryan-looking mummies in China. These mummies are so well preserved. The babies have pure white skin, blue eyes, and blonde hair. That's how well preserved these mummies are, and they were dressed in plaid swaddling clothes. Joseph's coat of many colors. Dr. Hans Günther, professor at Berlin University in his Racial Elements of European History, published in the late 1920s, writes, quote, "The investigations into the traces left behind them by that widespread Nordic people, the Sakha, with its many tribes, are well worthy of attention, indeed. But the Jews and Judeos are not interested, nor are the secular Shabbos Goys. It had been living on the steppes of southeastern Europe and spread as far as Turkestan and Afghanistan and even to the Indus, of course, before those areas were known as Turkestan and Afghanistan and India. The ancient writers such as Polemon of Ilium, Galenios, Clement of Alexandria, and Adamantios state that the Sakha were like the Celts and Germans and describe them as ruddy, fair, just like David. David is fair and ruddy. The Scythian tribe of the Alans and Swaves, that's my ancestry, and the Dona Schwaben, Danube Swabians, the Alans and Swaves travel together. Two sub-tribes of the Israelites, and they migrated up the Danube River, one of the last migrations. The Scythian tribe of the Alans are also described as having a Nordic appearance. Ammianus, about AD 330 to 400, calls them almost all tall and handsome, thank you very much, with hair almost yellow and a fierce look, We have seen that the names of the Massagete and the Thisagete evolved into Goths. The Ostrogoths are East Goths, and Visigoths are West Goths. And by the way, Spain was settled by the West Goths. It was the Jews and Moors who invaded Visigothic Spain, which finally threw off the Moorish and Jewish yoke under Isabella. So these people, the historian Ptolemy, who died about 150 AD, mentions a Scythian people descended from the Sacae by the name of Saxons, who had come from Media. Albinus, who lived in the 1st century BC, also says the Saxons were descended from the ancient Sacae. Genesis 21:12, "In Isaac shall thy seed be called Saxons." The ancient Sacae in Asia, and in process of time they came to be called Saxons. Prideaux reports that the Cimbrians came from between the Black and Cat, and that's Cimbrian is just another variation of Cimmerian, from between the Black and Caspian seas, and that with that came the Angli. The Angli and the, oh, what was the other? The Angli and the Egli are both of Ephraim. We are now well into established European history. Might get all of this in. I have to read pretty fast. But this is good stuff, folks. We are now well into established European history. By the beginning of the 4th century AD, many of the Goths were already Christians. In the 4th century, there were several collisions between Visigoths and Rome. And then here again, this is the Saxon, Scythian, Israelites versus Zarajuda Israelites, the Romans being Zarajuda. And in 410, the Visigoths became the masters of Italy and captured Rome. Later, they moved on into southern France and northern Spain, where they settled permanently. The Ostrogoths settled in what is modern Hungary about 455 AD under Theodoric the Great, good guy. They conquered Italy about 493 and set up an Ostrogoth kingdom in Italy, which, however, was short-lived. Their descendants are the fair-skinned and blonde Italians of northern Italy. If you want to see what they look like, just look at the four-year Olympics, the Winter Olympics, because it's those blonde-haired, blue-eyed northern Italians who are, in fact, Germans that represent Italy in Olympics every 4 years at the Winter Olympics. But the Goths had ended the Roman Empire, God's battle axe again destroying the kingdoms of the Babylonian order of empires. Amen. Well said. Okay, a couple more paragraphs here because we're just about out of time. The Angli and the Saxons moved up the Danube Valley and settled in Germany and along the Baltic shores, as is well known. From there, the Jutes, tribe of Judah, folks, the Jutes, Angles, and Saxons colonized England after the Roman legions were withdrawn in AD 408. Actually, the earliest waves of migration penetrated to the farthest edges of the European continent, partly because they could move through nearly empty lands without meeting any people strong enough to effectively resist them. In fact, the prediction, the prophecy of Yahweh says that he would send us into a wilderness. There were very, very few people in Europe because Europe was still, had come out of the Ice Age. Virtually all of Europe was under ice, and therefore there were very, very few people living in Europe. And if there were any, they were also white, who were living on the seashores of the Atlantic and of the Mediterranean. These would have been the only people in Europe before these Israelites migrated up there. And one more sentence here. Actually, the earliest waves of migration penetrated to the farthest. Okay, I said that already. Hence, we find the settlement of the Scandinavian peninsula pretty well completed before the arrival of the Jutes, Angles, and Saxons along the southern shore of the Baltic Sea. And here again, we have intertribal warfare. And we'll complete this. There's only three paragraphs left, but we're out of time. And so we'll pick this up again next Friday night, and we'll continue with more articles from the internet talking about the migrations of the Caucasian Israelites. Folks, it's undeniable. We Caucasians are the 12 tribes of Israel, and anybody who denies it is either ignorant or insincere. Thanks for listening. Praise Yahweh, pass the ammunition. And, of course, tomorrow, Restoration Hour, I'm going to start reading from Jewish admissions of their Babylonian heritage. And it's going to be good stuff. And then, of course, at 3 o'clock Eastern Time, Paul English and I will be doing the history of Jewish economics, Babylonian economics. So more and more good program coming up, and we're looking to have new hosts joining the Eurofolk Radio crew. Thanks for listening. Take care. See you next time. Yahweh bless you all. Y'all, as the Southerners say.
Pay attention, Israel. I've got something on my mind. Why must marriage be so hard? My people wander, following the blind. Why can't you